Well, tonight we're going to be talking with a physicist about science fiction. That's right, wizards, aliens, and starships. So get ready. Charles Adler, our guest in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Charles Adler, physicist, lifelong science fiction enthusiast, received his degrees from Brown University, full professorship at St. Mary's College of Maryland, and one of the United States' best public liberal arts colleges, of course it is. He is interested in light scattering and was the chairperson of the 10th Annual Light and Color in the Open Air Conference back in 2001, 2010. Here's Charles Adler with his work, Wizards, Aliens, Starships. Hey, Charles, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me here.
Me too. How did a physicist get so interested in science fiction?
Well, I've actually always been interested in science fiction. It's actually science fiction that brought me around to science in some ways. When I was pretty young, probably 10 or 10 years old or so, I discovered some of the novelizations of the Star Trek TV show around the house and started reading them, started getting intrigued by them. And then, you know, I started watching the TV show because I discovered that there's a TV show based on the books. So I started watching Star Trek and reruns. And that got me really interested in the neat ideas they were presenting there, you know, travel to the stars, alien life, things like that. And I pretty much went into science because of Star Trek and TV shows like that and the books that I read like these novelizations, and that led me to some more of the science fiction authors. But it also led me to realize that a lot of the science ideas they presented, you know, some of them were good and some of them weren't very good, and started making me think also very seriously about how you kind of tell these apart as well. Science fiction in a real way got me very interested in science, and science in a kind of weird way got me also interested in these ideas in science fiction again as well.
Well, it's exciting, and both being a physicist and engaging in science fiction is something else. Tell me a little bit about that Light and Color Open Air Conference. What is that?
Oh, okay. Well, this is something completely different from the science fiction. There's a bunch of about 100 scientists around the world who study a field called atmospheric optics. If a kid asks you, for example, Daddy, why is the sky blue?
Yeah.
We're the sort of people who go around and actually answering questions like that. What makes the rainbow the colors it is? Why do you see these weird sometimes lights squinting in the sky around the sun, the sun dogs, and atmospheric halos and things like that? So we look at actually the interaction of light with the atmosphere and with the landscape, and look at the scientific origins of all these phenomena.
How about like what's the light of the Big Bang and what was the Big Bang?
Oh, well, okay. That's a bit larger than the atmosphere, but the light from the Big Bang is basically the heat left over from the Big Bang. What's called the cosmic microwave background. We see it basically everywhere we look in the universe. And essentially, as the incredible energies, the Big Bang was basically the beginning of the universe, when the universe itself more or less kind of expanded outwards from this. I'm not even sure you could call it an explosion. It's such a huge thing that, you know,
whatever
the universe
it was,
started,
yeah.
Whatever it was. It started out from this point and expanded outwards. And in the beginning, the universe was pretty much opaque. It was very dense, and radiation basically and matter interacted really, really strongly together. There's a lot of, the light went around was constantly being scattered, being absorbed, being re-emitted. Once the universe cooled down enough, a large amount of the light, all of a sudden the universe became transparent. The light stopped interacting with most of the matter in the universe. And what we're seeing now is kind of that a lot of the remnants of that light, once the universe became transparent and the universe itself kind of expanded out and cooled down, that light basically got shifted from the really, really, really short, really, really, really energetic light that it was to basically microwave at a temperature of about, 3 degrees above absolute zero. Basically, what we see, whenever we look in the universe right now, we see as the remnants of that really, really intense, very hot fireball back shortly after the universe started. And what we're seeing now is kind of the cool down remnants of that everywhere we look right now. And that's kind of the light from the Big Bang, yeah.
When you looked at science fiction, movies, television shows, what kind of a job do you think they did, Charles? I think, for example, do you remember the Jetsons, the cartoon show?
Yeah. I think the Jetsons was a fun, you know, was a fun fun cartoon. I remember all the beginning, when the mother kind of stuffs the boy into the, goes to the shower and gets the clothes put on and stuff like that. Occasionally in the morning, I really want that in the morning every so often.
Exactly. But, I mean, they had flat screen TVs, flying cars and everything. And, and so when science fiction is done like that, who comes up with those ideas that eventually, in some cases, become reality?
Well, that's a good question. I think that if you look back, there's kind of this sort of core. It's a good question. I guess the best answer to that is the writers come up with the ideas, but they're, I think, in some ways, kind of extrapolating off of, you know, what's around them at the time and what they think is going to happen in the future. And sometimes the ideas are very, you know, very accurate, and sometimes they're really kind of wildly off base.
Do they talk to futurists, for example, and they say, tell me about this Dick Tracy watch that you can talk into and stuff like that?
Well, I think that's an example of futurists looking, or people, inventors now looking backwards on that sort of thing. But if you look at the communicator, for example, I think there's a famous story about Leonard Nimoy. You know, he's walking around Hollywood one day, and he pulls out a cell phone and, you know, flips it open and starts talking with it. And someone's walking by and says, "Oh my God, I just saw Mr. Spock with a communicator." And so, Star Trek, you know, got more or less got the idea of the cell phone right. And I think that there's a science fiction novel called The Mote in God's Eye, where the authors, Larry Niven and Jerry Purnell, essentially predicted the modern cell phone as well. They had this idea of this device that kind of fit in your pocket that could access any information anytime, and, you know, any sort of information you wanted from anywhere.
Jerry, by the way, Charles, a dear friend of ours, and listens to the show religiously. He's probably listening to you right now. I'll get an email from him during the break. I know.
Oh, my goodness. All right. Well, better be that's very humbling to realize. He and Larry Niven got the modern day cell phone right. The idea that you have this little device basically accessing the information that you want.
Yeah.
But science fiction writers also got some things kind of pretty, some predictions pretty wrong as well. I mean, I think if you look back to the 1950s, for example, a lot of science fiction writers imagined that, you know, by the year 2014, space travel would be essentially common and cheap. If you, you know, for example, the movie 2001 starts off with one of the main characters, Haywood Floyd, taking a Pan Am shuttle to a big space station.
Well, you know, it should have been common and cheap. Had they not stopped the moon program, I think, and had they continued onward beyond the shuttle, I think we would have had that kind of cheap space travel, which they're just starting to talk about now again. So maybe they weren't off as much as we think they were.
Yeah, I think looking at the space, the proposals for space tourism today are pretty interesting. If you look at it, what I should say is that I think that a lot of the authors got the science very, very good. I mean, if you look at people like Arthur Clarke or Robert Heinlein,
and Bradbury.
Back in the 1950s, they got the science. They were very good about the science. They knew really well how you could get people to the moon. Rocket Ship Galileo, for example, really great novel. Still a lot of fun to read. Was written in 1947, and Robert Heinlein described pretty accurately how an atomic-powered spacecraft would work. You know, he's got a bunch of Boy Scouts basically building a spaceship to go to the moon. And it's a great novel, and it's a lot of fun to read. But I think that a lot of the people there kind of assumed that the biggest costs in terms of getting into space would be the fuel costs. And if that's the case, if you look at the fuel costs alone, basically tell you that you can actually do this. I mean, it's expensive. The fuel costs are pretty expensive, but they're not horrible. They're not, you know, they're not overwhelmingly expensive. But right now we're in an era where I think that most of the costs of space travel are actually dominated by more by other costs associated with the space program. The cost of mission development, the overhead costs associated with, you know, maintaining very large staffs of people for every, you know, for every mission, the cost of actually developing the science for the missions, the cost of all the overhead costs associated with the spacecraft kind of dwarf right now the actual cost of the fuel that go into the spacecraft. And until we can actually bring those other costs down, I think we're probably not going to see space tourism. So I think that the science was very, very good, but the business model, so to speak, wasn't there yet, and is not quite there yet, I think, either. Until you actually figure out how to make these other costs go way down, I really regret that because I actually would love to take a trip to an orbital hotel, but
it is amazing.
Or to the moon. What?
It is amazing at how some of these science fiction writers, though, would predict these kinds of things in the future. They're almost like they're, you know, versions of Leonardo da Vinci or something like that.
Yeah, well, these are very, very bright people. I think in the book I made the point that many science fiction writers are true amateurs of science in the sense that, you know, if you look at the word amateur, it means basically someone who is a lover of something. And a lot of science fiction writers are real, true amateurs of science. They're, you know, they really love the science that they're looking at and study it very intensely. And in some cases, know a lot more about certain branches of science than many scientists do. And you know, it is pretty wonderful because I think a lot of the best science fiction writers know so much about so many different topics that is kind of amazing. If you look at, for example, Poole Anderson. One of my favorite authors, he wrote a lot of stories in which it makes it very clear that not only did he understand science at a fairly deep level, he also knew history and sociology and economics, all these things which you don't really find in a lot of other authors, and many scientists for that matter either.
Do you have a favorite science fiction writer?
Poole Anderson's up there. I really love his work. Larry Niven is another one. I like Jerry Purnell's work as well. A lot of these authors are the authors I kind of grew up reading. So a lot of the authors are people who are back, you know, writing back in the 1960s through the 90s, typically. One of my favorite authors, however, goes way back much further than that, and is an author by the name of Olaf Stapledon. He's probably not familiar to a lot of the listeners, but he was a British author. He wrote most of his works, I think, during the 1920s and the 1930s. And what's kind of amazing about his work, he was another of these people. He was a journalist and kind of a philosopher by trade, or journalist by trade and kind of a philosopher by inclination. But he wrote these four just kind of amazing novels, science fiction novels, back in the 1920s and 30s, one of they're kind of amazing for their scope. One of the novels, Last and First Men, basically details the entire history of the human race from the time he was writing up until a time billions of years in the future when the human race is, you know, when the human race has gone through many, many different, you know, types of mutations, essentially we'd call them, and alterations and things like that, and describes basically this entire history of the human race up until, you know, basically modern times, until the time that it dies off billions of years in the future. And he wrote another book called Star Maker, which is essentially about the entire history of the universe and all the intelligent beings that live throughout everywhere in the universe, including intelligent stars. You get this idea that, you know, the stars were somehow conscious. And he introduced a lot of different science fiction ideas. For example, a lot of the listeners have probably heard of the idea of a Dyson sphere. Freeman Dyson, you know, this idea of this shell surrounding a star to gather all the energy of the star for all these really, really highly advanced civilizations. Freeman Dyson basically said in one of his writings that the inventor of the Dyson sphere, at least the inventor of the scientific idea of the Dyson sphere, basically got the idea from all of Stapleton's works. And so Stapleton is one of my favorites because of this just enormous sweep of vision that he had. I love Larry Niven's work. I love Robert Heinlein's work as well. I really enjoy many of Ursula Le Guin's works also. I don't know if you really call him a science fiction writer anymore, but I really like some of Neal Stephenson's works and William Gibson's novels as well.
And you dedicated your book to Poole Anderson. Right?
Yes, and in particular because not actually for his science fiction work, but because he wrote this wonderful essay called How to Build a Planet, which I read when I was very young, and which is essentially very similar to the book in spirit. Wrote this essay basically about, you know, if you're writing science fiction, how do you pick a habitable planet? How do you build a world which is suitable for alien life? And he wrote this beautiful essay. It's about, I don't know, 20 pages long or so. I don't think it's in print anymore anywhere, but if people can find it, it's actually really worth reading because he really talks about all the science that went behind, you know, what star, you know, if you pick a star, then how far away the planet do you put the planet circling the star? How big can the planet be? Here are formulas to calculate the surface gravity of the planet. Here's how you determine the atmospheric composition. All these things which are really useful for a budding science fiction writer or reader to know and to realize that, okay, well, if we want to make a story which is scientifically accurate, here's what you have to do. And I just love that essay, and if it weren't for that essay, I probably would not have written this book.
Charles, does science become science fiction, or does science fiction become science?
I remember listening to a series of lectures on literary criticism of science fiction, and one of the statements that the person made there was that we basically live in a science fiction world today. I think it actually happens kind of both ways, that, you know, science becomes science fiction and vice versa. Or science fiction becomes science. And, I mean, for example, we now, for many, many, many decades, science fiction writers were writing about planets circling stars other than our own sun and life on these planets. And until the year 1993, you know, scientists had this idea that there were probably planets circling other stars. Our star is not a particularly unique star. The science that formed the planets was probably not a unique happening. The formation of stars should probably entail the formation of planets circling the stars. Planets are in some sense a byproduct of star formation. For a fairly large class of stars, they should be. And so science fiction writers predicted this idea of planets circling other stars. You know, we hadn't seen them, but, you know, they should be there. Well, in 1993, our technology got good enough that we started actually detecting them.
We found them. Hold on for a second, Charles. We'll be back with more in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, we're going to talk with a few astrologers about some of the events unfolding through the eyes of astrologers. So make sure you're part of that program. Next hour, we'll take phone calls on science fiction with the physicist Charles Adler, author of Wizards, Aliens, and Starships, and much more to talk with him about when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Charles Adler with us. Charles, as you were talking about how science is finding these Earth-like planets now all over the place, just a matter of time, I think, when we will realize that they're probably inhabited, huh?
Well, yeah, I actually, well, I have a little widget on my computer that JPL puts out, JPL Planet Quest, which actually counts the current number of planets that are out there. And the widget saying right now, looking at it right now, it says there are 709 known planets. And to me, that's pretty amazing because, you know, we know of 8 planets in our solar system. So, in fact, the planets we know of now outside the solar system kind of outnumber the ones that are known inside the solar system by something like 100-1. It says there are 0 Earth-like planets that have been found so far, meaning that none of them probably are within either what we call the habitable zone, you know, the zone basically where we think that life could take place, at least Earth-like life could take place, either not too close to the star where it gets too hot or too far away where it gets too cold. But you know, I think it is only a matter of time before we actually detect life on another planet. And I'm actually hoping that I live to see that day, in fact.
How exciting would that be, Charles?
Oh, it would be the most, I think in some ways it would be the most important scientific discovery ever made, the idea that we are not alone in the cosmos, that life, even if it's only of the form of vegetation on another planet, or bacteria even, that, you know, that we are, you know, that we basically are, that there is other stuff out there that's like our planet, I think would be the most important scientific discovery ever made.
What do you think of H.G. Wells and his work?
I love it. It's a lot of his stuff was not, a lot of the science probably hasn't stood the test of time, but a lot of it, but I think a lot of it's very, very good. And he's an excellent writer. I loved War of the World. I love the novel War of the World and The Invisible Man. I think one of the things that's underappreciated about him is that he was one of the best things about his work, independent of the scientific ideas in it, was just how good he was at depicting the behavior of people in very highly stressful situations. You know, in the War of the Worlds, you have the Martians invading, and it's being told from the point of view of the narrator. He goes into hiding because of the Martians invading, and he's trying to work with this other guy to figure out how to, you know, strike back at the Martians and all these different things. And it's a wonderful, it's a very well written, almost a horror story. You know, you have these Martian invaders, and they're depicted very inhumanly, and they've got these machines that are unlike things that anyone has seen, and they've got Wells thought of the idea of the laser, you know, sixty years before it was invented, and so it's a wonderful book, and I still come back and reread it every so often nowadays.
It's a classic, isn't it?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. I love it. It's actually well worth reading today. I think again, a lot of the older science fiction writers are actually still very worth reading. Olaf Stapledon, I also mentioned Olaf Stapledon, who wrote, I guess, about 20 years after Wells did. Who's a very, very good writer also. These people, H.G. Wells and Olaf Stapledon also were really very familiar with the best scientific ideas of their time. If you read them, you realize that they actually knew a lot about science and the science as it was understood. For H.G. Wells back in 1900, for Olaf Stapledon in the 1920s, and were very up-to-date, knew a lot about the most up-to-date theories. H.G. Wells, when he talked about this Martian civilization, was essentially referring to the works by two astronomers, Giovanni Schiaparelli and Percival Lowell, who saw these markings on Mars through the telescopes that they interpreted as these giant canal systems to transport water around this very, very arid planet, and interpreted that as basically being life on Mars. And we know today that wasn't true, but they were actually, Wells was writing stories based on the best science of his time. And Olaf Stapledon, again, in his book Star Maker, was, again, very, very familiar with the cosmological theories of his time. He knew about the Big Bang. He knew that, Hubble had discovered, not the Big Bang necessarily, but he knew about the expansion of the universe, that Hubble had discovered the expansion of the universe, I think, in the 19-teens. And so he was, again, very, very familiar with that. And I think that's a hallmark of some of the best science fiction today is, again, science fiction writers tend to be really knowledgeable about the most about the latest, most up-to-date scientific theories. And that, I think, is what separates very good – that's what separates, I think, the good science fiction from the not-so-good.
When you look at science fiction and mm-hmm. then you look at the possibility of extraterrestrial life mm-hmm. out there, what are your views, Charles, on visitation, the fact that they may have already been here?
My feeling is, first of all, if you look at all of the history of life on Earth, you know, the last 4 billion years, it would be very, very difficult to say that, you know, if the aliens came by 1 million years ago and landed and you know, walked around and then went away, it would be very hard to say that they hadn't, that they'd actually come here back then. I think my gut feeling is that they probably haven't. And there are two fundamental reasons for this. The first has to do with cosmic timescales. If you look at how long the cosmos is, you know, if you look at how long the universe has lasted, the universe has been around for, the universe has been around for the last 14 billion years, and life in the universe has been possible probably for something like the last several billion years, something like the last 5 to 10 billion years, life has been possible. It's very hard to say, however, how long a society like ours, a technological civilization, which is capable of contacting other stars. You know, right now we could probably, if there were aliens in another star system who were as technologically advanced as we are, we could probably detect them, maybe, by their radio broadcasts. Although
that's what SETI's looking for, but nothing yet.
Right, exactly, but nothing yet. And you know, and there are issues involved there. You know, the radio broadcast in the last, you know, the last couple of decades, our, you know, the Earth's radio noise, the radio broadcasts have decreased in power as our civilization has become, you know, more wired up. I don't know how you want to call it, but again, you could probably detect a civilization from across the cosmos based on the electromagnetic radiation they put out. In the form of radio waves or other things like that. But it's not clear, to me at least, how long civilizations like that last. And the problem is that if you're talking about a myth, if a civilization like ours lasts, you know, 1,000 years or 10,000 years or 100,000 years, that's still a very short time compared to cosmological timescale.
Yeah, it's a grain of sand, isn't it?
Right. Yeah, and it's a little blink. It's like a firefly at night. You know, it may be that civilizations like ours are like fireflies at night that flick on very briefly and flick off. I hope they're not. I really do hope we actually, you know, our civilization lasts a very, very long time. But you know, but if they are, then if our civilization lasts for 100,000 years, even very, you know, very long time compared to the even to the span of human history, if it lasts for 100,000 years, but then goes away, and another alien civilization comes to life in a nearby star system 1 million years from now, which is very short on a cosmological timescale, they wouldn't necessarily know we existed. That's one issue why I think it's unlikely. You know, it's one of these things where, if you look at civilizations and how long they last, and if you look at the rise and fall of various different human civilizations, even they last for 1,000 years or so, and then sometimes fall, you know, crumble. It's not clear how long our technological civilization will last, and if there, you know, even if we have a fairly large number of different civilizations spread throughout the galaxy, alien civilizations spread throughout the galaxy, it may be that no two of them are around at the same time. And again, I really hope that's not true. You know, I'd love to meet the aliens or hear from them at least. The other issue has to do with energy. If you're actually going to go and visit another planet, if you want to actually go visit another star system, and do it in a time scale which is not kind of overwhelming compared to most, you know, compared to, say, a human lifetime. If you want to actually go to Alpha Centauri, the nearest star system, is a distance of a little over 4 light years away. If you remember the movie Avatar, that's the star right. system the movie Avatar was set in.
But maybe they've learned how to bend space and time.
There are theories of physics that indicate that's possible, that you can somehow travel faster than light by bending space and putting a wormhole through it. That still takes enormous amounts of energy. I want to make myself very clear. Let me backtrack a little bit. If you want to send a spaceship traveling at a fairly large fraction of the speed of light, so you do it conventionally. If you want to send it at relativistic speeds, that it takes a few years to get to another star system, then that takes an enormous amount of energy. Mm-hmm. An object with just, you know, like weighing 2 pounds, 1 kilogram, basically traveling at 50% of the speed of light. Basically has the same amount of energy that, in terms of motional energy, kinetic energy, that the United States uses in something like an hour. And so that's a lot of energy. And it's again, if you look at the proposal, you know, people have speculated about this idea of wormholes as well. They also take enormous amounts of energy to create. And so you have to believe in a civilization that has access to just humongous amounts of energy if you want to start talking about travel between the stars on any reasonable time scales. And so, again, I'm not saying that it's an impossible thing, but it's very difficult for me to see how civilizations can get access to those just enormous amounts of energy that are needed for that.
What do you think of the multiverses, Charles, or other dimensions?
It's an interesting idea. I like the idea. I like the idea that there are constant, that there are all, you know, that there are these little baby universes popping into existence all the time. I think it's one of the neater, I think it's one of the more interesting speculative ideas of physics. I don't see how it could be proven or disproven. That's one of the things about it is that it would be very. And again, you know, the idea here is that quantum mechanics, you know, the laws of quantum mechanics, in some sense, allow the idea, you know, allow sort of little baby universes to come into existence and, you know, expand outwards into universes like ours, essentially, you know, all the time, and kind of separate out from our space-time. And again, our universe may have been such a thing when it began. I think it's a great, I think it's a very interesting idea, and I think it's a really neat idea. I don't know how it could be tested, though. I guess it's the best thing to say. So I'm kind of neutral on it in that sense. In the sense, I don't know how one could actually go about actually finding the existence of it. But it makes a lot of interesting. Sorry, go ahead.
As you look into the future,
mm-hmm.
where are we headed? What's out there? If you were writing a science fiction script today, Charles, what would you put in there about the future? Things that, gosh, I can't even imagine. I mean, we've just about done, you know, mm-hmm. other than time travel and things like that, we've done just about everything, haven't we?
Yeah, I think we've done a lot. I think that that's kind of an interesting statement because I think it's very hard to predict the future because, a lot of the things that we predict, that science fiction writers predicted, have come true, and it's very hard to see how we can actually go beyond that. But I think also, though, in some ways, science fiction writers actually missed a lot of things. For example, the enormous computer revolution that, you know, science fiction writers, I think, missed that when they were writing back in the 50s or 60s or 70s. Missed the fact that computers would, you know, shrunk down by the huge amounts that they have, you know, they have today.
They missed text messaging. They missed that totally, didn't they?
Right, exactly. They missed text messaging. I think, again, like I said, Larry Niven and Jerry Purnell, you know, have this. Yeah, exactly. They missed text messaging. They missed how much computers have kind of permeated our lives today. If I were to write a science fiction story, I would probably actually concentrate on the small rather than the large. Because I think there's actually... the physicist Richard Feynman wrote this amazing article back in 1974 called There's Room at... it was called something like There's Plenty of Room at the Bottom, where he wrote about the fact that if we looked at miniaturizing things, if we looked at making things smaller and smaller and smaller instead of larger and larger and larger, the laws of physics actually really allow a lot of things to be made on much smaller scales. You know, he basically put together, he offered this $1,000 reward for people who would build these tiny miniaturized motors, or I think write the first page of the Encyclopedia Britannica on the head of a pin or something like that. I don't read the exact details. But he lost his bet very quickly because people were able to figure these things out. But he pointed out, again, that the laws of physics allow for a lot of things to be shrunk down. And, you know, this was at a time when I think a lot of science fiction writers were actually thinking about really large things, you know, Dyson spheres and space travel, things like that. And so, you know, Richard Feynman more or less invented the idea of nanotechnology back in the 1970s. And if I were writing a science fiction story, I suspect that what I would probably write it about the effect that things like nanotechnology, the ability to, you know, the effect that 3D printing, the idea that you can actually build...
That's
amazing. You can actually have an... What? Sorry, go ahead.
3D printing is amazing to me.
Yes. And you know, and I think maybe one of these days we'll actually see a 3D printer in every home. As the technology gets cheaper and cheaper, as it gets possible to build these machines, you know, for less and less money, you know, are we going to see a time when you can actually go up to a machine in your home and actually basically have it, you know, build a toy for you in your home, or, you know, build a, you know, I don't know what the limits of this sort of technology is. You know, could you have a machine which would build you a cell phone, build you a television set, build you more or less anything you need in your own home? What would be the ramifications of the civilization based around kind of the intensification and the miniaturization of everything? Or could you build, you know, people have talked about these, you know, when we think about space probes, right? Again, we tend to think of large objects traveling, you know, traveling to other worlds. But, you know, John von Neumann back in the 1950s had this idea for self-replicating small space probes. And again, the exploration of space by, you know, probes which would, you know, by small probes which would require relatively little energy, which could go out into space and make copies of themselves. And so I think that, again, like Feynman said, there's plenty of room at the bottom. And if I had to write a science fiction story, I would probably focus on the things that can actually be made smaller. And again, one of the things I really am very interested in just is the idea of the miniaturization of probes for space travel. Can you make tiny little probes?
Almost like bird size?
Or even smaller.
Mosquito size.
Mosquito size. Could you make a probe the size of a mosquito that could actually tell you anything interesting? Could you send it out into outer space, you know, for a tiny fraction of the cost that you can with today's things? Could you actually send it out on a mission? Could you actually send it, you know, if you could make it that small, all of a sudden the energy costs become pretty small compared to what you'd need to send a larger...
Well, that's
you could even
true.
Imagine... Sorry, yeah.
Yeah, we've got a lot of people. Charles, hold on. We're at the break, and we'll be back.